It's XM, baby, and we're very serious. To call Art Bell, please manipulate your communication device and call 1-855-REAL-UFO. That's 1-855-732-5836.
Not yet. Not with the phone calls, but it'll be soon, relatively soon. Here's one of my two commercials. Bob Crane has had tons of calls about my program, wanting to know how to record and archive my show.
I love music.
The CC Witness Plus is the way to do it. Now, I understand that a lot of you listen, stream the program, still looking for that elusive 1001 error, stream the program on your computer or, I don't know, your phone, whatever. So this is the answer for you. Maybe we're not on at a time that you like. So, you get the CC Witness Plus, hook it up to whatever, you know, your laptop, your desktop, your phone, your tablet. God, there's so much these days, right? And now that, of course, you're not interrupted with a 90-minute timeout, you're ready to rock for 4 hours, and you record the show and then listen to it at your leisure. The CC Witness Plus comes with 2 gigabytes onboard memory. It'll take a 4 gig SD card. This way you can take your recordings anywhere you go, listen anytime you want. No use being stuck on a computer or at a computer, right? Comes with 20 timers, easy to program piece of cake, easy CD quality, creates CD quality recordings. Has an AM/FM radio built-in and a microphone built-in, so it's good for all kinds of things. Small stereo speakers. You'll never miss out again on a show with the CC Witness Plus. You can order right now for $149.95. No, it's not cheap. But I know most of you folks can afford it. $149.95. The number to call for the company that has nothing but quality, C. Crane, is 800-522-8863. 800-522-8863. Now, once again, Dr. Roger Lear. Dr. Lear, we've got a subscriber base on XM of around 27 million people. That's a bunch of people. And, you know, a lot of them haven't ever heard my program before. I had Whitley on about, I don't know, within the month. And we all know, I know anyway, Whitley had an implant attempted to be removed from his ear. And there are those who doubt what Whitley says. I'm not one of them because I know the man really well. But you were part of the team that tried to remove that implant from Whitley's ear. Am I right?
Partially right. I met the physician who was the guy that tried to remove it from the ear. And had quite a conversation with him, and I listened to his explanation of what he saw, how he panicked when it moved out of the way.
I would. And in other words, when the scalpel came near, to be clear, the surgeon says the implant actually moved in Whitley's ear, yes?
That's correct. It moved out of the way, but he was able to get a little piece of it, which was sent in for pathology, and there was some mysterious material, but there wasn't enough there to really make a determination what it was. And then later, Whitley wanted me to take another shot at it, and I said, well, you know, if that's what you want to do, and you're 100% sure, I'll do it. And then he said, can you guarantee me that after it's done, I won't be dead? And I said, no.
That's a stopper.
Yep.
That's a showstopper.
So
I remember, maybe you can tell me why doctors do this, Dr. Lear, but when we had Asia, when my wife was in labor, actually, you know, the doctor had been telling her, it was a C-section, and the doctor had been telling her every visit when we'd go, you know, for the normal checkup, everything is fine, everything is great, it'll be a C-section, piece of cake, nothing to it. And then when you're actually in the hospital, You're in the bed. You're in the middle of labor. The doctor stands at the end of the bed and says, I need to read you this list of risks. And there's this long list of, well, you might stop breathing. You might die. And, you know, it's like a showstopper. Of course, in that case, you can't stop the show. But, my goodness, they wait until the last moment to redo the risks.
Well, that's not right, because you're supposed to have that list all done and signed before you ever plunk your fanny in the bed.
Well, she might have done that. She might have signed and not exactly known. You know, I mean,
well,
you get a lot of papers you have to sign.
Really not too good bedside manner to, I suppose I went to an ophthalmologist and I was going to have a cataract done, and I signed all the stuff, and at the last moment he says, well, this procedure is just an ordinary procedure. We've done thousands of them, but
yes,
you could wind up blind.
Yes, that's right. So anyway, Whitley said, you can't guarantee me I won't die, and you said no, and that stopped that, so...
Yeah, so
but
it's still in his ear. It still moves. At least it was the last time I talked to him. But, I can't make that kind of a guarantee. Lord knows what could happen. We don't know what's going to happen from day to day if you never touch his ear or whatever.
Especially
if
he got carried away, I guess, and began chasing it around his head.
Yeah, he was actually telling me he had a meeting with one of his publishers, and it got bright red and hot, and he had to run out and go to the restroom and put some cold water on it to cool it off.
It's not that funny. I have seen his ear turn red. I've seen it myself.
Yeah, he showed it to me one time, too, when it was glowing beautifully red. Not to change gears, but I just want to take this opportunity to thank a few people. One is Keith Rowland, who did a wonderful job of getting the immense amount of material I put up on the website up in time for the show. And nextly, I didn't get a chance to thank you for the great, wonderful, marvelous, fantastic quote that you gave me that we used in on the back of the book, I believe, for a UFO crash in Brazil.
Mm-hmm.
That was just something that I will always thank you for the rest of my life.
Oh, thank you. And you're right about that. There's a very great deal of photography up on the website, and you can follow along, folks, by going to artbell.com. Just find the name Roger Lear. He's our only guest listed with a human name. Click on that, and then you'll come to the material here, which we're about to talk about. So you might as well get it on the screen, along with so much else to watch up there. Now, I'm not sure where to begin. I guess I'll leave it to you. There's so much material that we have to go through. But, I'm right at the first picture, 4:59 a.m., May 15th of 2009, and I guess I'm looking at something that was taken out of somebody, or what am I seeing?
Well, I believe if you're seeing a date, you're probably looking at a UFO, and that's probably part of the material from the Comburgas, Turkey UFO, which showed up 3 years in a row. I just happened to be there. And looking through the camera when that was filmed. So there's a large amount of material on that UFO. Now, the camera we were using was a camera with a 300-millimeter lens and an electronic doubler. That means that you can double it to 600 millimeters. Let me explain what the situation was at the time. There were three conferences that went on each year. And following the conference, during the conference, let's go back, UFOs were passing over the conference center like looking at the traffic on a freeway.
Where was this?
This was in Istanbul, Turkey.
Right, okay. Just to give you some idea, Doctor, when I look at this photograph, it could either be a large object far away, or it could have been something you removed from somebody's ear. In other words, in the first two photographs, there is no reference for size.
Right. It was when we get farther into it, you'll see the estimates of our. This was taken out over the sea, and it was from the European coast. So the investigations that were done on the video gave us, you know, maybe it might have been 20 miles away.
Wow.
Also, the sky was clear, but the moon was bright, and the craft was being lit by the moon. However, if you go down to the following pictures, you'll see that as we push closer and closer and closer on the craft, we can see that the front end of it is rounded.
Oh, my.
And it has
I'm looking at the video now. Oh, my.
Oh, my is right, because this has got to be, and after you've looked at the whole thing, I'm sure you're going to agree, this has got to be the finest footage that was ever taken of a UFO. Not only that, but it shows the occupants.
I think I see them. I have a question right away, if you don't mind. My God, that's incredible. I'm running the video right now. That really is incredible. What is it, Dr. Lear, that lights up the craft or puts a light on the craft? Can you tell me? It kind of comes and goes.
The craft is being lit from the outside. Now, the camera is on a tripod, but there is a slight wind blowing, and the camera is focused on the front of the craft, but the craft does move. And you'll see that in one of the shots there, it kind of turns sideways, and although from the front of it, it looks like it's saucer-shaped, you'll see it's not. Boomerang.
Yeah, I'm sorry. It is definitely a wow. This is really good stuff. You want to click on the video, folks, and just sort of let it run in the background as we're talking. And I do think it looks like you can see two occupants in what would be some kind of cockpit, right?
Right. There's three ports that show, one in the middle and one on either end. Now, as you get farther down into the video, and you get not the video, but when you get down into the stills, and we get to the analysis part, the analysis on this video was done by the University of Istanbul, which is a government university, and it created a stir in all the newspapers, national newspapers in Turkey, all the television stations.
I should hope to kiss a cow. I'm sitting here watching this now, as I hope a lot of the audience is, and... Wow. This is, and the other thing is, this is going on while you're at a UFO conference in Turkey.
That's right. This is right after the conference
ended.
We went down the European coast to the small town called Comburgas, and we stayed up from midnight till 5 o'clock in the morning filming out over the sea. And in one instance, this was 3 years in a row. I think it was the last year. I'm not 100% sure. I think it was the last year, 2009. Jaime Masson and his crew were there, and they were filming it also. So there was two sets of original videos that were taken of this. Now, Jaime had analysis done in Mexico. Hatan Agolan, who's the head of Sirius TV and Sirius UFO organization in Turkey, had the analysis done by the University of Istanbul. And then it went to a fellow, Mario Valdez, in Chile, who used a frame splitter. Now, for those of the audience that's listening, a frame splitter splits each picture that goes by the television camera lens into two what we call fields. Now, the film goes by the lens at 30 frames per second. So when you split it in half, you get 60 frames per second. So he studied each individual field, and his concentration was on the occupants of the craft. And you're going to see when you click on the investigation part of this, his entire report is there, and he has made specific outlines and drawings of what these entities were doing while we were filming them.
Holy moly. This is such clear stuff. Was it just basically hovering out over the ocean in one place, or was there much movement associated with it? Because to, you know, keep the camera on it at this distance, it must have been relatively stationary.
It was relatively stationary, but for whatever the reason, it did make slight turns to one direction and then slight turns to the other direction, because sometimes you're getting a better view of the port that's on the left side. Sometimes you're getting a better view of the port that's on the right side. And then finally it turns sideways, and you can see that it's not a disc. But, you know, remember Bill McDonald?
Oh, sure.
Well, Bill McDonald, you know, made a drawing of what they considered the Roswell craft to look like. And, boy, if this doesn't fit that drawing, you know.
It sure does. It's a definite boomerang shape, and it's also got significant. There's two different shots, one where you've got the thing strobing lights all over the place like crazy, and
right.
then many shots where it's not strobing lights like that.
Right. And, you know, why, what are they doing, what's their intent? We've had a few people that tried to debunk it and say that, oh, this was nothing but the reflection of lights from a fixed source on the water.
Oh, please.
And stuff like that. I had one the other day that got me through the website, and he said he's a video analyst, and this has been photoshopped because you can see where the 009, when you analyze it, looks like it's below the other. Well, in the first place, I wrote him back, and I said, you know, I thank you for the time that you took for your analysis, but number one, please give me your credentials, and number two, please tell me where you got a copy of the original film from, because there's only two copies in the world. With that, I never heard from him again.
Well, I'm about six minutes and 40 seconds into it. This is astounding stuff, folks. Wow. What a good lens. I mean, that thing's way out there, and when you get the camera just right, you're able to get very close to it. Wow. That's
something. We surveyed the whole area before we ever filmed anything. We looked for oil derricks. We looked for other platforms, light sources, ships, reflective objects, and there was nothing. I mean, there was nothing out over the water. Now, I don't know if you saw the part yet, but there was a dog standing there on the beach looking at the object, and he's just barking his barker off.
Yes, I absolutely saw it. That's just a remarkable video, and I don't know why it's the first time that I've ever seen it. Well, I was out of the country, and now I'm down to the still photographs, which, wow. These, I guess, are frame grabs? Is that what I'm looking at?
Yes, these are frame grabs.
Holy smokes. The one June 8th, 2008. Now, that's a year, nearly a year before the other one, right?
That's correct. They were,
Speaking of dogs.
Speaking of dogs, yeah. You talk about dogs barking on the beach. You see, these are just so smart that they, talking back to me.
So, in other words, this craft had been visiting this area for quite a long time.
Well, now, I discussed this with one of our physicists, and he came up with a very interesting approach. Why did it show up just about the same time for 3 years in a row at the same time of the night?
Really?
At the same place, at the same geographical location? And he said this might be an indication of time travel. And what we're looking at might be a time loop.
Wow.
And he says,
all right, I have a question, an obvious question, I guess. If this craft had been showing up night after night after night in the same place, time loop or not, and that's something we can talk about, why wouldn't a local military have sent something out to try and figure out what was violating their airspace?
In Turkey, that's kind of a strange situation because in Turkey, there's so many UFOs that unless they interfere somehow with human activity, no military force goes up, no police helicopters, no nothing. Nobody does anything. It's so common. You can read about it in the newspapers. You can hear about it on a television show. It's not that exciting. It's like you were talking about the 18-wheel rig. You know, if it was an 18-wheel rig and it was a 1941 model, that might create some great, news. But when you're in a country where it's so open, now they have had instances. For example, in Turkey, there was two instances where commercial airlines became so close to circular craft, saucer-shaped craft on landing. That they became dangerous, and their version of the FAA, was really worried about it. Now that did cause some military and commercial stir.
Well, you did mention Jaime Monzon, and you know what? Down in Mexico, it also got so common. In fact, they actually had a couple of, I believe, collisions between UFOs and commercial aircraft. But it got so common in Mexico that otherwise it was like almost like part of daily life or something.
Oh yes, that occurred after the eclipse. It was like every day. And the same way in Brazil. Brazil, I've been there at least 12 times. And it's so common in Brazil. It's the only country I know of in the world where you can pick up a tour guide and they tell you where to go see UFOs.
Do you have any thoughts, Doctor, on why these other countries are so frequently visited? We had our Phoenix Lights, but I mean, other than that, in recent years, there hasn't been much here compared to, say, Turkey or, Mexico and South America. And any thoughts on why?
I do. I think that we think that we're not as visited as much as these other countries, but that's because the cloak of secrecy is so strong here that when people talk about it, report it or whatever, it never goes anywhere. There is a blackout on this information, and this is what we were trying to do with the citizens' hearing. And it's my hope. Now, I just was served on a committee with Senator Gravel again for you had James Fox on for 710. And I was supposed to be in that film, but because of a mix-up, something happened at the last minute. I wasn't in it. But just the night before the filming, I was with Senator Gravel. And they are pushing forward. And I think this is really going to happen. We're going to get a hearing before the General Assembly of the United Nations.
Really?
I believe so. They've got he's got a very powerful group in Washington, and he's donated a corporation to the cause, which is a nonprofit 501c3, and it looks like he's got the contacts and the ability to raise the money to get this done. So it's not just him; it's Congresswoman Carolyn Kilpatrick, with several of the other members of the committee that were there too, that are all for getting this done. And you should have heard the difference between their opening statements and their closing statements. I mean, they said they were open. But after 5 days of testimony from 9 to 5 every day, listening intently to what everybody had to say, they went, I'm sure 180 degrees. And they came out and said, this is not a U.S. problem. This is a situation which is worldwide. So, we're not going to get the representation from Congress, but Steve Bassett is still under the opinion that if we drive hard enough,
he's plugging away,
and he's fortunately been able to raise the money outside the country to do things like this. So these events are tremendous, and they're tremendously expensive.
Okay, when. Let's take our break here and pick up on the other side. I want to talk a little bit about that time thing, the possibility that It was movement in time again and again and again.
When I think back on all the crap I learned in high school, it's a wonder I can think at all. And my lack of education hasn't hurt me none. I can read the writing on the wall. Hold a throne.
To turn to dark matter. No, it's not a trick. Just call 855-REAL-UFO. That's 855-732-5836.
All right. Dr. Roger Lear is here. He is a surgeon. He removes alien implants from people. I can't believe it. I keep getting these messages on the wormhole saying, Art, where's the video? I can't find the video. Oh, please. Go to artbell.com, scroll down a little bit for the name Dr. Roger Lear, scheduled for today, then click on his name. First, you'll see some still photographs. Then you will see the video in question. It's a little better than, I think it's about 6 minutes, 40 seconds, something like that. And this is really good stuff. And, again, Dr. Lear said, it came back over a very long period of time and suggested that perhaps it was some sort of time loop, which is interesting. If it were some sort of time loop, then one would imagine or guess that it might not actually physically be there, and yet it was able to be photographed, both video and still photographs. So a time loop, doctor, you think... You really think that's possible? It's fascinating.
Well, that's what, a lot of my material doesn't come from me because I really don't consider myself a scientist. I do have degrees in, medical biology and so on.
Right.
But I'm not a PhD material specialist. I don't have degrees in physics and so on. But we have four nuclear physicists now on the board of NS Research. The latest one came out of the citizens' hearing, Dr. Tom Vallone, who had the ability to put up a formula at the hearing on two giant television screens, a formula for zero-point energy. There it is.
Really?
I mean, we were looking at it. The Congress people were looking at it. Everybody was looking at it. There it is. He says, this is the formula. So, you know, these are the kind of people that I respect their opinion. So someone comes to me and said, perhaps, why you're getting this around the same time of the year, 3 years in a row, is that these entities have the ability for time travel. Now, they could have been doing this for a specific reason. You know, they obviously know our history. They certainly know a lot about human beings, the anatomy, physiology, psychology. There seems to be a few things that certain numbers of races that are non-terrestrial don't know, that they're still learning about us. David Jacobs with his hybrid program, I agree that they are making hybrids, but I unfortunately don't agree that that's the only thing that's being accomplished by the abduction phenomena.
Well, you brought up the name Dr. Jacobs, so I really have to ask you, there's a great argument in ufology about whether these beings are friendly or not friendly, foe. And Dr. Jacobs, by and large, believes that they are not friendly at all. I wonder if you buy into that, or how do you feel about it?
I can't take science and agree with that opinion, because if they were not friendly, why would we be even here having this conversation? Now, one of our nuclear physicists, Dr. Robert Koontz, is an ex-naval physicist and with a background that's a mile long. I didn't send that along because it's just too much material, and perhaps we can talk about it another time. But
sure.
He's one of the physicists that's on our board, and he has made mathematical calculations based on the isotopes that are in the implant objects as to their relationship to the Big Bang theory. In other words, if we take the date of the Big Bang, he can calculate a constant, which he can use in a formula. And he figured out mathematically two things, which have been so far not disputed, that the elements that we're finding in these objects, these isotopes, come from one-third away across the Milky Way galaxy.
Wow.
From a civilization which he says is 80 to 100 million years older than we are.
How are they able to make that determination?
It's all with advanced mathematics, and it boils down to basically how Uncle Stan Friedman can say, if you live in New Jersey, you don't go to the Bronx to buy your bread. So if the materials come from a certain area, then you can tell by how long it took the change from one isotope to the next element, how long it took to get there, and you can figure out the age of the civilization. That's the best as I am able to explain it. It's much more complex. So again, I have to take the word of a noted world-renowned physicist.
Okay. How... with respect to the implants that have been removed and tested, how many of them have actually shown isotopes that would lead a person away from Earth?
Well, we've done 16 cases, removed 17 objects, and you were correct in your summation in the beginning. One of them did have two. Now, in the early days of research, and this is probably what I was talking about so many years ago, the first test that came from Los Alamos laboratories in New Mexico Tech compared them to meteorite samples. So we've gone a long, long, long way since those days, because science, our science, has advanced also. We have better machinery, better mechanics. To give you an instance, your question relative to the numbers of the objects that we removed, how many of them show extraterrestrial properties. We know that most of them are showing extraterrestrial properties, but we don't know until we look. So now we're able to take advantage of going back to what we have left of the original objects and looking at them again. To give you an example, a scanning electron microscope, which uses a high voltage, a kilovoltage, to put out an electron beam, and then the electron beam can give us pictures at various depths through a material object. Years ago, when we started doing this, let's say 10,000 kilovolts, you were able to get maybe 100,000 times magnification. If you went higher than that, you'd get what's called scattering, which is just a bunch of electrons bouncing all over the place. Mm-hmm. We wouldn't get a decent picture. Now, with 10,000 kilovolts, you can get magnifications of around 500,000 to 600,000 times. You go up to 20,000 kilovolts, and you can get very close to a million magnification. We can get down things now to looking at one atom. And that's one of the things that we see in these objects are apertures that are only one atom wide. The next thing that we've found, and I'm kind of getting ahead of the game here, but are carbon nanotubes, both single-walled and double-walled carbon nanotubes.
Whoa, slow down. You're saying some of these implants contain carbon nanotubes?
That's correct. And 8 years, 9 years ago, academic scientific community was arguing whether a carbon nanotube could even exist.
Because
it doesn't exist in nature, and you can't make it. It can't be done. Well, here they are. And now our objects, you know, one of them, when we took it out, was 42 years old.
Right, exactly right. Way ahead of anything we could have done anywhere near that time, probably even now.
Yeah, you could dump all the money in the black budget. We're in projects in the world, and you wouldn't have come up with a carbon nanotube. But these go far, far more complex than what is even talked about today, because you can build a single wall, you know, a tube, but you can also build a double wall. And that's what we find. And then let's compare it to those that don't understand what a carbon nanotube is. It's a carbon atom which is connected to another carbon atom, and it forms a chain, which is in a circle. And then you extend this chain, and you get a chain of carbon nanotubes. Atoms, and this is a carbon nanotube. So you can double a wall, and you can have twice the thickness, but there's a hole in the center. And the hole in the center can be what we call doped with other material. For example, one of the uses today that they're talking about medically is to put, let's say, an antibiotic or an anti-cancer agent, let's look at it that way, into a small carbon nanotube, and that's called doping. And then you inject that into a malignant tumor, and the carbon nanotube then releases the anti-cancer drug directly into the tumor, and you don't destroy the surrounding tissue. So there's lots of applications that are being talked about today, but now we can make them, but we can't make them the complex way that we find them in these objects. Now, the other thing is, how do you combine a carbon nanotube into molten metal?
No idea.
No one else has any idea either. But here it is, folks. You know, you look at it, you see it, you know, with new equipment. And these carbon nanotubes are then, you know, let's take a wire, for example, without any insulation on it. And you take the wire and you wrap two wires together. You know, and then you continue doing this until you have, a cable. And then you throw some insulation on it, and you got an insulated cable. So this is what we find with carbon nanotube technology in these objects. Now, where do they go? They go with a pattern like a circuitry. And remember, we're looking under an electron microscope that's looking at this about 750 to 850,000 times magnification, and they run into what we call orthorhombic crystals. I know that sounds tremendously
right.
complex, but it's not.
Way over my head.
It's very easy to explain. It's a crystal that's a rectangle. Simple
okay.
rectangle.
All right, here's a question for you. Here's a question for you, Doctor. Do you have any knowledge of, or guesses even, how these various implants interact or associate with human biology?
We have some idea. We used to think that they were being powered by the nervous system, as is UCLA now powering small motors to run servos in artificial prosthetic devices. But now we've kind of changed our opinion because we know that you can broadcast energy. And if you broadcast energy, for example, by use of a scalar wave, you can power these objects remotely. So let's just accept that as a possibility. The next thing, in reference to your question of how it's used in the human body, obviously these things we know are being used to relay information of some kind of data, a data pattern.
How do we know that? And what... For example, those who have had the implants, what are they saying? Are they saying, I hear voices, or I have ideas that I don't recognize as my own, or what?
Oh, that's a wonderful question. Now, here I'm going to bring it home right in your own backyard.
Sure.
We have a radio frequency detector, and we've been able to detect radio frequencies coming out of these objects.
All right, stop right there. You're finally into an area where I sort of know what I'm talking about. What range of frequencies are you talking about, and what kind of emitted signal are you talking about?
They're in the FM band, and I unfortunately don't have the exact figures, which goes out to about a 10-digit number, but they're both in the kilohertz and megahertz range in the FM band.
You're talking about the commercial broadcast FM band?
This is a band I was able to, let's see how to put this. I was able to view a secret chart with all the frequencies from every satellite that is circling our planet put up by every country. And these
okay.
are in a category of fixed or mobile deep space frequencies.
Okay, but when you're talking about the frequency emission from the from these implants, I mean, we're talking about two different things here. You're talking about a list of frequencies from satellites orbiting Earth or whatever. And I'm talking about the implants themselves apparently transmitting some sort of signal? Is
yeah,
that correct?
Yes. Yes,
okay.
They are they're both in the kilohertz and megahertz range. As I said, I don't have the readings. I'd be happy to send them to you.
I would very much enjoy that.
Now, one of the things we don't have, and we keep trying to get someone to donate this to us, but we have the radio frequency detector, but we don't have a radio frequency analyzer, so we can't capture the wave.
Now you're talking about pretty big money here. If
yeah,
you want an analyzer.
I know. The new digital ones are quite costly, but I think we could settle for an old analog one.
So if you were to get a donation by somebody, you wouldn't be unhappy about that?
Not unhappy at all. We would certainly pass this information right back to the public where it belongs.
Okay.
The other possibility is here, and you got to consider this, no matter what radio wave it happens to be, I really agree with Stan Friedman when he talks about SETI as being a silly effort to investigate. What advanced civilization, especially when we have a physicist that's telling us these are 80 million years older than we are using radio waves to for some kind of a communication or data collection device? That's preposterous. So there's either two things, one of two things going on if you look at it logically. Either there's a deal made where the information that's being broadcast from these objects is being received here by some earthly source, and they're tapping into the information that's coming out going somewhere else. It's a piggyback sort of thing. Or what we have is a, again, this is more in your area than mine, so you can probably tell me, scalar wave technology. When it comes into our electromagnetic spectrum, we're getting a harmonic that looks like a radio wave, but rarely may not be.
Well, that's testable.
And we know that scalar waves are faster than the speed of light. And Tom Ballone, the physicist in Washington, testified before the committee that this is a way to communicate in deep space. And you don't have to wait for 4 years to get your answer back.
Well, I deal in radio waves that go at the speed of light or just a touch below it, not with scalar waves. So I don't know a thing about scalar waves. You're saying they're faster than light.
That's correct.
I didn't know that had been proven.
Oh, yes. Yeah, that's accepted modern technology. Tom is not only a theoretical, but he's also a mechanical physicist. So the things that he's investigated, he's already done in the laboratory. So when he comes up with these statements, I mean, it's already been done.
Well, I wasn't aware of it. I was aware that quantum movement has certainly, if there is communication, is faster than light, certainly. But I don't know about scalar waves, so maybe. Anyway, you, where do we move from here? Where would you like to go from here? I know you've got a lot of material up there.
Well, let's see. I've told you some of the things that we found in the objects that we've removed with more modern techniques. Let's hit on a few other ones. Some of the things we understand, some of the things we don't understand. And when we see the carbon nanotechnology involved with these orthorhombic crystals, we know that crystals, since the beginning of radio, have been a very important device for the receiving of radio frequencies. So this is this kind of advanced crystallography, if you want to put it that way. But we also see objects that we don't understand. We see gold spheres that are about 4 to 10 atoms in diameter. We don't know what they're for. We find other inclusions of metals that we don't know what they're for. I told you about the one atom apertures.
Right.
We're not sure what they do.
Dr. Lear, if I can, let me drag you back to the question I asked, and that is, and you said it was a good one, what do you know about what these people report, these people who have things in them? Are they being told things? Are they aware of some communication that's being made with them? In other words, I'm looking for some clue to what these things are doing.
Okay, I'll let you have it for the full bag. Now,
sure.
Scientifically, which I like to stay with the scientific approach, opinions, are
but,
fine.
But not all of it has to be. I mean, if people are reporting that these things are controlling them or giving them ideas or communicating in some way, I understand it's not scientific, but I'd love to hear it.
Okay, well, we're looking at a different ballgame. Number one, why is the abduction phenomena going on in the first place? We have to
okay.
go back
All right.
to that.
Let's do it.
We know that, and I've been in 42 countries in 7 years, so it's relatively the same in the United States as it is in Brazil or in the Middle Eastern countries or in Africa. It doesn't make any difference. Some of the entities that are seen may be a little bit different, but 99%, I would say, of all abduction cases involve the taking of ova and sperm. Now, whoever is taking this thing, it doesn't work for the Cooking Channel, and they're not making omelets. obviously, there's, you know, you've got to theorize there's some kind of a genetic experiment going on.
And I don't want to hear about sperm and the Cooking Channel in the same sentence.
sorry about that. Couldn't resist. But anyway, so there's some genetic experiment going on, and I think it's an experiment which I partially agree with David Jacobs. I think the human race is being altered, and I can give you a number of instances where this might be a factual scenario that we are witnessing now. I remember years ago, if you remember John White, who used to put on the conferences in Connecticut.
Yes.
He coined the term Homo noeticus, and he said that the human race was eventually becoming Homo noeticus. I think that's what the kids for the last 50 or 60 or 70 years are becoming. They know things. They know things without learning.
I know. So many people have said this, Doctor, and they're called by various names, but I think it is fair to suggest that many, many children currently alive are of a kind of a different, what's the right way to say it without offending somebody? Well,
It's Homo sapien becoming Homo noeticus. It's an advanced civilization. And
All right.
I think there's a lot of examples, you know, if you want to look at the world picture.
Doctor, hold it right there. We're going to take a break. It's going to be about, it's a longer one. It lasts about 5 minutes or so. So just relax. Let me tell you about the Senta Ally portable speaker. This is an amazing device. Really amazing. Attention drivers. If you're listening to my show on your smartphone or your tablet because you don't have a satellite receiver in your vehicle, then you totally need the Senta Ally Bluetooth speaker. This thing is amazing. About 9 inches, kind of oval, with speakers in it, really good speakers, small but good. When I say it's, I don't know, 100 times better than the speaker in your little iPhone, that'll give you an idea, maybe. It connects by Bluetooth to whatever you've got. I mean, Bluetooth will connect to anything, right? So you pair it, and away you go. If you've got a lot of music, as an example, on your iPhone, suddenly it's coming out of the Senta Ally and sounding like a full orchestra. It's got batteries that, get this, will last for up to 10 hours, and it's rechargeable. It's one of the best speakers for the human voice. So if you pair it up to your phone, and then you're playing Dark Matter, it's going to sound really good. To order the Senta Ally portable speaker, for what a price, too, $69.95. And again, it will pair to anything, Bluetooth, anything. Call C-Crane right now. They have operators standing by. 800-522-8863. The C-Crane Company and the Senta Ally Speaker. What a deal. Also available at Amazon.com, and you can see it at C-Crane.com. I'm Art Bell. This is Dark Matter.